seconds, then I'll bring you in at
Blog
the intro.
Talk Radio.
Welcome to Midrack, where the Navy Millblog community's top bloggers discuss the latest developments, long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody, for episode 15 of Midrack. And this week's topic is international navies, building off of what we did last week, which was multilateralism at sea. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander. And my co-host is the ever-genial Eagle One of the blog Eagle Speak. Hope everybody's having a great Passover Easter. And for my pagan friend up in Maine and everybody else, welcome to spring, otherwise known to the former vice president as proof of global warming. That's your one joke for the day, by the way. Our guest to talk about international navies will be Eric Wertheim and returning guest and good friend of the show, Commander Henry J. Hendricks, Jr. So kick back, enjoy yourself, and thank you for joining us, whether you're with us live, getting the archives from Blog Talk Radio, or downloading the podcast from iTunes. For those of you listening to us live, make sure and scroll down to the bottom of the show page and join our live show chat with the usual suspects. If you have any questions, Eagle One will be riding herd on the chat room, and he'll fold those in with the show as it goes. Our first guest, Eric Wertheim, is a defense consultant, columnist, and author specializing in naval and Air Force issues. He was named to the helm of the internationally acknowledged one-volume Naval Institute reference, the Naval Institute Guide to Combat Fleets of the World, back in 2002. He also served as a speechwriter for senior Pentagon officials from 1994 through 2004 and wrote the bi-monthly Lest We Forget column on historic U.S. warships for the Naval Institute's magazine's Proceedings. Since 2004, Eric has written the monthly Combat Fleets column for Proceedings, and his annual review of the World Navies runs in the March issue of the magazine. He's a co-author, along with Norman Polmar, of the books Chronology of the Cold War at Sea, Dictionary of Military Abbreviations. Both of those are published by the Naval Institute Press. And Eric, welcome to our Easter edition Saturday special of Midrats.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
Great, and again, thanks for taking time. I don't know about where you are, but we're having a beautiful Saturday afternoon. I've got kids and everything running in the backyard, but that's okay. It's a good opportunity to talk. Let me just kind of come out of the bracket here. And with looking at combat fleets of the world and what our international partners and not-so-partners are up to in the world of the Navy, when you look back at the last decade, as shipbuilding programs have advanced. And one thing that I've noticed is, just to pick a few nations out of the hat, you have one of my favorite ships, just from a conceptual standpoint, the Absalon from Denmark. You also have Japan's 18,000-ton, they call it a destroyer. Of course, it's a helicopter carrier, and they're going to build on that with one that's 19,500. The French command ship, Mistral, the German Berlin-class oilers, and even the Italians with their latest 20,000-ton carrier, there seems to be not so much a power projection, but a desire from a lot of these navies, most of which we could call our friends, to be able to get more of a global presence. Obviously, they don't have enough to be a regular presence by themselves, but to integrate themselves globally. Do you see that as really a new trend or an extension of an old one? Or what other larger trends have you seen in the last decade in the international naval arena?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think, of course, navies have a role in the peacetime world that a lot of the other military services don't have, and that is that they play a very important role protecting the sea lanes and being able to shift between peace and war. And one of the things that happens is navies need to be ready for anything. They are, during the Cold War, they used to argue a lot of times, they are out there doing what they would do day in and day out, even when the bullets are not flying. Now, of course, we do have wars in Iraq and Afghanistan going on, but we also, those navies are also doing things like countering piracy and ballistic missile defense. So what I think you see is this trend of the international navies to stay involved in, for instance, humanitarian efforts like what happened off of Haiti. And these very large ships, amphibious ships and transports, enable these navies to transport large quantities of assistance aid and also troops, if need be, when they transfer to a warfighting role back from an aid role. The difficulty of these ships is they are very vulnerable in wartime. And one of the main ways that these ships are vulnerable in wartime is through submarines. And we see a rapid proliferation of submarines, especially in Asia. And we're seeing rapid naval buildup in the Middle East. So the trends are really increasing for naval power. And as submarines and these types of amphibious ships and across the board more capable warships sprout up, they some of our allied navies can in turn become more vulnerable.
Eagle One.
Well, that I guess that poses a question. Are we going to see a build-up in anti-submarine forces now that we're seeing a build-up in submarine forces?
I'd like to say that I think that is the next step, but unfortunately, I'm not as convinced that anti-submarine warfare forces are going to be building at the same pace. I think that while submarine forces are, of course, probably the best way to counter enemy submarine forces, they are in a large degree being built with the capability to take out anti-shipping. We see to take out shipping and enemy surface ships. We see this especially, for instance, in China, where there's a very heavy emphasis on countering access capabilities with their submarines, for instance. The goal of their submarines does not seem to be so much taking out other submarines, but taking out other enemy shipping through mine warfare and, of course, torpedoes and anti-ship missiles. So I think that we're lagging a bit in the anti-submarine warfare realm since the end of the Cold War, and I think our allies are as well.
I think what's kind of ironic with that is if you look prior to World War One, I mean, there's a trend here, World War One, World War Two. You even saw it in a couple of the short wars more recently, like in the 71 Indo-Pakistani War and the Falklands War, where there's an underinvestment in anti-submarine warfare because it's expensive to do, not just from an equipment standpoint, but from a training standpoint and a personnel standpoint, is that it's a long chess game vice a sprint. So I see the same thing where the submarine threat is growing, but the acknowledgement, whether it's financially or intellectually, to be able to counter that by some questions, it's really not there. And that's not just an international problem. I think the argument could be made when you get past a second beer with some guys to talk about our own national focus on anti-submarine warfare, that perhaps we aren't really cognizant of being able to do that for any extended length of time or even a medium length of time like you saw with the Brits down in the Falklands.
Yeah, I think that the other area that we're vulnerable in is that as we move towards peacetime operations and humanitarian relief, one of the things that's the biggest concern for me is that we will lose the need to be able to be the top warfighter. I mean, that's really what a military is about. And the missions of air defense and surface warfare and submarine warfare, and for instance, the air forces, air defense, being able to counter enemy fighters and bombers, those things are preeminent. And I worry often that with the move to humanitarian assistance, which is vital, and with the move to international cooperation and international communication, I do worry that there is not the investment in weapons technology, for instance, anti-ship missiles are a major area where I consider that we're outgunned. And in some ways, air-to-air missiles, you can argue, we're losing the technology edge.
Eagle One.
Well, that if that's true, what's the answer? What kind of ships should we be developing, and is there a way to get our allies, the international navies, to cooperate in developing them? I mean, is it along the lines of the Aegis ships that are Japan and Korea, South Korea, are developing with us, or do we go off on some other direction?
Well, I think there are a lot of answers. I think one of the biggest problems is that a lot of times we see a ship and we see that as a whole, something that's whole. And really what it is it's a system of systems. So, of course, we have – I like to sometimes see a ship as a truck that's carrying weapons. And you can change the capability of this truck by changing its weapons. And all too often we get rid of ships that are still usable and then 5 years later complain we don't have enough ships and have to start all over again. And this creates a very difficult problem. We saw this with the Perry-class frigates as they leave service, as we've neutered them by taking the missile launchers off, and while other countries have been working to upgrade them. We see things like this happen, and I think that what happens is the smaller things like weapon systems, missiles, when they cancel the harpoon, the next block of longer-range harpoon missiles, and with retargeting capabilities, and when we saw, for instance, the radar jammers that are canceled or taken off the out of the budget, those are things that are the little things that can make big differences. But I do think there are some real bright spots, and one of them is the joint strike fighter, the STOVL variant, the short takeoff and vertical landing variant, the F-35B, I think is a real bright spot, and it's being overlooked. Because the Air Force and Navy, the Air Force in particular, is not a big fan of Joint Strike Fighter. But what this will provide the Marine Corps, the F-35B, is a capability to put a really highly advanced fighter on its amphibious ships in capable quantities where you can theoretically fill in for a carrier based on the fact that in the future they're looking, for instance, also to take the V-22 and turn it into an AWACS platform. I think that has a tremendous potential when tied with a Joint Strike Fighter variant to be able to put on, for instance, a WASP-class amphibious assault ship.
I think another really neat thing about the F-35 is when that capability, and if it gets out as advertised, which it probably will, it's not just the Marines. The Brits are going to prosper, the Spanish, the Italians, the Indians, anybody that has these small to medium-sized carriers who had been relying on the Harrier are just waiting for bated breath for that platform to come on, because it really will leverage their capabilities going forward. You know, who knows whether down the road the Japanese might be interested in that, maybe the Koreans, but it really would help tie those things together pretty well. I wanted to back up for something, because I like the point that you made earlier when you're talking about systems of systems and trucks is what you put in the trucks. And when you look at the service Navy, its truck is the Mark 41 VLS cell. And they're sitting there, and oftentimes it's what goes in it that's important. But you look at the Australians on their own, and they had some hiccups, but they got through it okay. They're upgraded to their Perrys, where they've put, I believe it's 8 VLS cells right in front of their one-armed bandit launcher. And I also read that the Turks are looking of doing something very similar with their very high-quality Oliver Hazard Perrys that we have given them. I know I got an email from our friend Byron a while back, and there's lots of tears in Mayport when the McInerney goes over to our friends over in Turkey, because it really is a good ship with a lot of more life to give. And that little VLS cell really opens up the aperture on taking these older platforms that still have a lot of life and a lot of good mission to do. And I know that we've sunk a few Spruances that if they were maintained a little better while they were here, they could still be tooling around doing some very good things for the taxpayer.
Yeah, I very much agree. I think one of the conundrums we have is that we have to keep the shipbuilding industry happy and building ships to keep that capability. And so oftentimes there's this balance where we want to keep building these ships, but we don't have enough. So we need to build more manpower required ships. And so I think that's where a lot of technology perhaps should be going. But the downside, for instance, of that is if they get hit, there's a lot fewer people for damage control. And so, you know, these are the things that we're dealing with. I do think, though, the Perrys were retired way too early. I think the Australians did really great stuff with them. I was on the Sydney last year, HMAS Sydney, and it's a great ship. And I think the Turks are also doing it, and they're showing us what we could have done had we kept those. They have two helicopters, which are valuable assets, and they've kept the missile launchers, and they've added 32 evolved Sea Sparrow missiles, and, of course, their 76-millimeter gun, and the rest of the armament fit.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that we can learn for some of our allies do, and we need to be a little humble now and then and look at what they're doing and why they're doing it, and see that maybe there's some things that we can learn from that. I don't know whether you had a chance, Eric, to listen to our episode last week. We had Hans de Vree, but from James Defense Weekly and also Radio Netherlands Worldwide. And one of the questions that I asked him is, when you look at the Netherlands and Denmark especially, you know, these are small countries. Denmark's 5.5 million people. The Netherlands is only 17 million in a nation roughly the size of Maryland and New Jersey, right between the two there. But an integral part of how they managed to keep producing their own ships and really nice civilian ships as well is a very good partnership, not the government running it, but the government, industry, and unions to make sure they can produce a quality ship on schedule and fairly cutting-edge technology, especially when you cut metal and put things together. Have you had a chance when you look at the combat fleets of the world to also look how different nations work their shipbuilding industry, and what are some of those lessons we could probably look at a little closer here in the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the Dutch have built tremendous ships. I think the Seven Provinsen class is among the most capable pound-for-pound warship and cost perspective that there is. I mean, it's essentially a mini Aegis ship that was bought for far less, and I think the Germans have the Saxon class that they are able to work with, and I think what happens is that they are in a better position, though, of not needing to do everything. The United States Navy has to do everything, and one of my concerns about the LCS, the littoral combat ship, is that it's not going to be able to do everything that we need to be. And oftentimes, I think the mission could have been done by keeping Perry-class frigates in service, for instance, with their helicopters and with things like that. The difficulty with this game of naval analysis oftentimes is that the decisions are already made. You can't, by criticizing, you can't really change the past. You can only have an impact on the future. And so now as we look to some of these things, now we have to say, how can we make the most and the best out of LCS? And I think that's where we are now. When we look at the shipbuilding industries, I think the other countries are able to say, what is it that we need, and build them while saying, more importantly, what do we not need? We maybe don't need to have Tomahawk missiles. We maybe don't need to have, an aircraft carrier or nuclear-powered submarines. We don't need to have this because we know the Americans are going to be there if we need them. We don't have that option.
When you look at the one of the lessons from LCS, I guess, if you want to look at that, and you look at, you know, the Seven Provinces class and Absalom class, have we kind of relearned the lessons about how probably it's good to have an inherent multi-mission capability vice this whole swappy concept?
Well, the what I've seen from, for instance, the Danish Navy has warships that are swappable. And one of the things that that the Danish Navy has done is they just put certain ships and they say, okay, this ship is in the mine warfare capability. Okay, this ship is in an anti-surface capability. And they just kind of leave them that way. They don't wind up swapping that much because it becomes a pain in the neck. And people aren't trained to the same degree in everything. So I think what happens is when it's not on their ship, it's not. You know, they don't think about it. And to the same degree that they might have to, for instance, if it, you know, an F-18 Hornet has to do both missions. But I think that those are the things that I think why I'm not such a big fan of LCS. I think it's going to work and it's going to be fine, but I think we could have done better. And we could have done better by working with what we had, which is, you know, the frigates, the destroyers. We could have done more with those, I think, rather than just scrap them and say we got to do something else.
Eagle One.
Well, it kind of points to a question that's been debated with Norman Friedman and Captain Wayne Hughes about, I think, you know, Friedman seems to still be looking at the blue water, and Hughes wants a more, you know, at least a green water, littoral water presence, and how are we going to deal with all these issues? And, you know, it looks like smaller carriers, more, you know, keeping ships or designing ships that are like the Perry-class frigates or maybe even stripping down some of the Burke-class hulls and turning them into something else, or continuing to build those and building them in a slightly different configuration. You know, maybe there's a window somewhere. How do you fit in the debate that goes on with those things?
Yeah, one of the things I thought about the Burke classes, and I think, for instance, the Burkes are great ships, but I sometimes think, going along my train of thought, is that what would have happened if we – one of the reasons we built the Burkes was because the Ticonderogas were too expensive. Let's say they cost $1 billion a piece. We wanted to be able to, at the time, we wanted to be able to build fewer of them. So what wound up happening was we spent all this money designing a new class of warship that at the time was slightly less capable than the Tychos, but they wound up being, let's say, $750 million at the time. I'm using approximate, you know, funding. But we spent all this money in R&D, and it would have been easier and less expensive, my argument goes, to have kept building Ticonderogas and improving those. Now, the Burkes, as I said, are great, but you have to look at the amount of money and what you get. And I think these are some of the things that we have to look at, is once we make a decision on something, like we did, for instance, with the Los Angeles and Ohio-class submarines, we were able to do the best we could with those and really move, advance them to different levels in ways that I think we haven't seen in the service community, because we have moved to different classes. Now, we've done that with the Burkes, in that they're now a much more capable platform, but I think the whole issue of not having enough anti-ship capability is a major one. And I've talked to a lot of Burke commanding officers who all would much rather a more capable anti-ship capability. I think those are some of the things. I think whoever made the decision, for instance, not to have the helicopter hangars on those initial Burkes, it was wrong. And then we had to alter the whole course of the warships. And what we had to do essentially was get back to the level that was in the Ticonderogas. And that, to me, is a real problematic difficulty when you wind up trying to save money, and in the end you wind up spending more and getting a marginally less effective platform.
Well, have you taken a look at this Japanese helicopter, carrier, destroyer? I'm not quite sure how they classify it. It looks like a really interesting ship to me. What do you think about that?
I think it really is, in so many ways, an interesting ship, not only because of its military capabilities, but because of what it says politically, that it's called a helicopter-carrying destroyer, because, of course, a carrier is deemed an offensive weapon, and they don't want to have an offensive military, so they have to classify it in this way. I do think that it shows what they're looking to do. They're looking to have this capability without looking to scare their neighbors. But, of course, as China in many ways becomes the big elephant in the room in Asia, and is the big elephant in the room, then Japan is looking less and less threatening. So I think that they are going to Japan is going to be more and more likely to start calling them carriers in the next 10 years instead of just helicopter-carrying destroyers. But they're going to be very interesting ships, and I think it really does show where the the navies are going, that so many are investing in this type of capability that maybe 10, 20 years ago might have been called power projection, but now maybe they're talking about presence or the ability to assist with humanitarian as well as, you know, aviation capabilities.
Eric, that's a perfect lead-in to the next question I wanted to ask you is, you know, the first question I asked you and what you just brought there talked about the Japanese and a few of the other nations who have these small to medium-sized carriers that, you know, give them an ability to have a presence and to participate in operations a little more variety of ways than just having a frigate. Now, on the opposite side of that is when you talk about China, you talk about a focus on sea denial. And when you look at how the Chinese Navy is growing in their sea denial capabilities, but also how the Indian Navy, as their economy increases and their military from a naval perspective matures, how do you see their neighbors looking at India and looking at China as their maritime forces increase in capabilities? And where do you think the Indian focus is a little bit different than the Chinese focus?
Well, it's interesting because I think that China is much more, they're much more desiring, I think, to be seen as a world power. They are a world power, and I think that they are looking to be independent of the rest of the world and be able to be a superpower to rival the United States, not necessarily to dominate the United States, but to be equal to the United States. Whereas I don't think, in my opinion, that India is looking to do that. India wants to have an important role and be respected, but I think that India is still trying to balance itself between the West and the East in terms of Russia and the West. Russia on one side and the West, the United States and NATO countries on the other end. It's a little bit like it's still stuck in the past. It has not been able to develop its own shipbuilding capability to the same degree that China has, and it's still very, very reliant on Russia. Overly reliant is one of the things I think that's holding up the Indians. And I think that that's a trend that doesn't seem to be going away. I did think that they were leaning more towards the West when they bought the Boeing P-8 Poseidon, for instance. I thought that was a very good sign. But then right away, towards the end of 2009, they signed another agreement with Russia to essentially concrete their you know, they're in a new industrial agreement that's a 10-year military agreement that seemed to be a step back. So I think that, that India seems to be dealing with a lot more issues about where it wants to go. It's not sure, and it sees itself not to the same power level as China does. If that answers your question.
Last question for Eric.
What of all the international Navy vessels you're taking a look at, which ones impress you the most at the present time?
Well, I think that that's a good question. I think that the anything that's capable of doing the type of mission like an Aegis ship, I think, are really very important. I think, for instance, the Seven Provinces I mentioned, the Seven Provinces of the Dutch class, the Horizon surface warships, the French, Franco-Italian, the FREM program is going to be very important. Those are the frigates that are multi-mission for between France and Italy. I think also some of the submarine programs are going to be very interesting to watch. I think the Scorpion programs, the French and Italian, the French and Spanish submarine Scorpions, as well as the German Type 214, Type 12, those capabilities are spreading throughout the world, and we have to really learn to deal with them. I think on the U.S. side of things, I really think that we need to invest more in our weapons technology, and so that if it does come to blows, we're able to engage with more than just a 3-inch gun, more than just, you know, a 25-year-old harpoon missile. And I do think that some of the European countries And the rest of the world does seem to be investing in some of this technology. Hopefully, the U.S. has not fallen too behind. But I do think there's some really excellent ships out there. The Seven Province is probably my favorite class of non-United States ships, though, if I had to pick one. And of course, the amphibious ships. Of course, the anything that can carry a Harrier can or a Joint Strike Fighter can make a big difference nowadays.
Well, Eric, thank you very much for taking time this Saturday afternoon to come on and join us. We've really appreciated it. You've been a very good guest.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great, and we hope to have you again, and have a good Easter.
You too. You as well.
And just a quick reminder to everybody who's maybe come in late, you're listening to Navy Mil Blog Radio Midrats. I'm Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host Eagle One of the blog Eagle Speak. Our next guest is well-known to Midrats regulars. He is Commander Henry J. Hendricks, Jr. He's the author of Theodore Roosevelt's Naval Diplomacy, the U.S. Navy, and the Birth of the American Century, and also a very popular article amongst my readers, and I believe Eagle One's as well, the 2009 Proceedings article, By Fords, Not Ferraris. And he has a follow-up article in this month's edition of Proceedings called Less Henderson, More Bonds. And we're going to get into exactly what he means on that in a bit and widen the aperture to a little bit of a wider discussion going forward. And Jerry, welcome back to Midrats.
Oh, it's good to be here, Sal. How are you today?
Doing quite well. I got a little yard work in. Did a little training with the new dog. Life is good down here. No problems. Hey, I want just leading off the bat here, and I'm using the word bat intentionally. If you could just talk over last year, the reaction to your article Ford Not Ferrari, and was it what you expected, and did you get some of surprise in some of the reactions you got to the article? And obviously, it has some legs on it. People have been talking about it on a pretty regular basis since you published it. And tell us how it serves as a lead-in to your latest article, More Henderson, Less Bonds.
Well, yes, I was surprised. I was delighted, actually, at the reaction. I've published a number of articles over the years in Proceedings and, you know, maybe got one letter or something. But in this case, you know, not only were there letters in the Proceedings for the next couple of months, but also the way the blogosphere lit up on it and the fact that I was having senior officers reach out to me personally to talk with me about the article and its implications. But I think the thing that struck me that was the nicest surprise out of it was the focus on the influence squadron aspect. The article itself spanned everything from influence operations through maritime security groups into carrier strike groups and talked about sort of force disposition and force allocation and looking at different roles and missions for all these things. And it was actually an extension of a theme that I've been writing on in recent years about the importance of the expeditionary strike groups, which I've kind of talked about before. And that was really where I was somewhat focused, was on the ESGs and sort of the jack-of-all-trades type thing that the ESG brings to naval warfare. But it was the influence squadron aspect that seemed to have gotten picked up. And then what really surprised me about that was that everyone sort of bought off on the idea of an influence squadron, but everyone wanted to disagree with me about the units that make up the influence squadron. And because of that ongoing discussion about what should be in it and what should not, and by mind you, that discussion ranged everywhere from bloggers in the Netherlands, in the United Kingdom, and as far out as Australia, people were talking about this. I decided that I would kind of go back and look at the influence squadron itself and drill down on that. And in doing so, also kind of consider the strategic implication of influence ops.
If you could explain to everybody, you use as kind of the reference point in your new article, Michael Lewis's book, Moneyball. Explain real quickly in a nutshell how baseball, and specifically some of the points he brings up in his book, what we can kind of learn from that way of thinking from a Navy perspective.
Well, the Lewis book was interesting. I'd recently I switched jobs within OSD in the Pentagon, and because of that, I had a lot more freedom. In fact, was encouraged to read more and read more broadly. And so I read two books that really influenced me and had an impact. One was Taleb Nassim's book on Black Swan, talking about these rare, unique events that have major strategic implications. And also, he was an investor, an options investor, and he talked about what he called a barbell investment theory, where he has a 10%, 90% investment strategy, whereby he invests 10% in sort of a highly competitive area, whereas 90% is invested very, very safely and very strategically. That affected me, and I began to think about the 10-90 split. And then the other aspect was the Lewis book about Moneyball. Now, the reason why I read Lewis was, you know, I have a child who's involved in fast pitch softball, and I was reading about this to think about the way that she needs to approach batting. And the thing that came out, and he made the argument, at least that the general manager of the Oakland A's, Billy Beane, makes the argument, that on-base percentage is really the critical thing in baseball. It's not your batting average, and it's certainly not slugging average. It's your ability to get on base. It doesn't matter if you're hit by the pitch, you get four balls and you walk, or you make a single. Getting to first base is half the goal of the game, because once you're there, you can create the opportunity to score. And there was no one in the history of baseball that was better at this than Ricky Henderson, who leads the major leagues on an all-time record for walks and, of course, leads the majors for steals. And so Henderson, despite the fact of having only a .279 batting average, scored more runs than any other player in history. And mind you, Ricky Henderson's salary, although very competitive, was nowhere near the salaries that were being commanded by sort of the high-end Alex Rodriguez, Barry Bonds, et cetera. But Henderson, in the end, produced more runs. And so this idea about on-base percentage, I began to equate to naval presence, that what really mattered in sort of this global economy that we have right now, whereby, you know, Brown is your warehouse and that half of our inventories are at sea at any point in time in containers moving from Singapore to the port of Long Beach, that what really is important is the United States Navy is present to maintain the international system of maritime trade, to maintain the commons, as it were. And unfortunately, as we've seen the price of our ships go up, we've seen the number of ships go down. And so we're not able to be present. And due to that lack of presence, we've seen sort of other powers, China being one, who have taken a very combatant interpretation of the global commons. The Chinese tend to view the EEZs, for instance, as having more sovereign characteristics than what the United States is comfortable with. And so as we've shrunk away from this, they've been willing to kind of encroach into these areas where we've set the rule set in the past. And so I really want to make the argument that presence is probably one of the most critical missions that we have, and we need to have the number of platforms out there in order to maintain it.
Eagle One.
Well, I've been looking at the some recent issues of proceedings, and the Mahanian doctrine and Roosevelt's fleet out there, you know, to get, I guess, I think you wrote, I think you wrote the article about, or somebody, why not, I've forgotten. There was a book review, I believe it was on your book, that talked about Roosevelt's influence on Mahan in his study of the War of 1812. All of which is going to get me to the point, how do you see international navies fitting into your influence squadron concept if we use our allies properly?
Well, I think that a number of other navies fit very well into the influence squadron. In fact, a number of the other navies are purchasing ships, much as I recommend in this most recent article of proceedings, which are sort of low-end coastal patrol boats that work in the littoral region, in everywhere from the brown water to the green water, and then having some effect in the blue water. And so reaching out to our international partners is important to bring them in. And, in fact, it's critical. In discussions with international partners, specifically in the Pacific, they've made it very clear that they want to see us, and they want to see us visibly, meaning you know, the implication is, hey, submarines isn't going to get this done because they're not visible. And we want to meet, you know, we want to have everyone know that you're there and that you're remaining strong and steadfast in your commitment to the region. That being said, I've become increasingly suspect of depending upon international partners. The United States has really never been in a position in the 20th century, at least the latter half of the 20th century, where we had an overwhelming dependence on them to fulfill our missions. And what we've seen most recently through the 1990s and then in this first decade of the 21st century is we've actually seen a decline in access and decline in cooperation with people that we've been able to really deal with in the past. Certainly if you look at the Italians and the restrictions they placed on us with Aviano, what we saw with the Saudis and some of the religious implications of operating with them and CENTCOM, you know, there's if we put too much dependence on them, then I think that we may find future roles and missions for us infringed upon. And so how do we build our own ability to operate independently while at the same time creating a force which can operate effectively with them when the situation calls for that? One of the things that we found in discussions here recently over the past 2 years is that a lot of the partner nations, coalition nations, like on the East African coast, West African coast, when we go over there to do building partnership capacity, they are overawed, and this is something that's come in through back channels. They are overawed by Burke-class destroyers showing up, and while they're out there with essentially their Coast Guard patrol cutters. And so there's not much that we can teach them from the bridge of a Burke with its Aegis systems and missiles down with these guys that are essentially operating, you know, with something that goes out, patrols for a couple of days, and pulls in. And so one of the systems that I recommend, or ships I recommend, is actually about 150-footer coastal patrol craft that is something that both we could operate and something we could export to our partners that we could actually work as a partner, coalition partner with them in similar technology. It's eminently exportable, and it's something that we can use in a region where we need to increase our presence.
I liked in the article when you brought that up, it's Austal's. I'm flipping through my papers here. It's 90 meters, and the price tag is what I got at $150 million each, I believe, is what we were looking at for that. And I think you hit on something that we've all seen, that you come off the coast of pick whatever nation you want, and here we have our billion-plus destroyer where there's no commonality of equipment. There's very little of any commonality with mission. We've been better off bringing a Coast Guard cutter out there that could talk about what a lot of these nations are concerned about, you know, fisheries patrol, things like that. But there's a lot to be said if you come across the horizon on a ship or with a ship that's very similar to what you have with the nation, you know, that you're going to visit. For instance, we go to Australia. My Perry class is looking at your Perry class, a little different. But you're able to work close together at. And another interesting thing I thought that you brought up there, you know, we talk about partnering with our nations, and a lot of what we do when we partner has to do with building relationships from a leadership point of view, is the discussion that a lot of these vessels could be commanded by lieutenant commanders.
Yes.
And you do see that in a lot of our partner nations, is they have what we used to have. We've unbalanced our fleet to the point that we have high-end ships, high-end commands, but we don't have very much on the low end. And even when we do, you know, you have a command that has less than 100 people called LCS, and we make it a commander command just so we can have enough people to go in front of the captain board. But we don't have that lower-end ship where we can come up and say, let's partner together, brother to brother, as opposed to great uncle to young sibling. What do you see that we've lost from the leadership point of view, and that we no longer give our hard-charging lieutenants and lieutenant commanders an opportunity to have command before commander time?
Well, I think you've said it quite effectively. The fact is by providing lieutenant commands and lieutenant commander commands, not only do we provide them with experience, it also provides us with an opportunity to break out superior leadership at an earlier point in time. And the thing is I think historically, and I always, you know, as a historian myself, come back to some of these historical analogies of Nimitz and Halsey and Spruance emerging with Lieutenant Commander Command very early in their careers. Did they make mistakes? Yes. Did they show great evidence of leadership and managerial abilities? Absolutely. And so we were able to identify them, select them, get them to the War College. They became involved with Plan Black, Plan Lead, and Plan Orange. And then when World War II happens, they were there. I mean, we had built the team, but they had already had multiple command tours. I mean, Ernie King had command of submarines, aviation, and surface craft by the time he made two-star admiral. And so this ability to get the young people out there, the younger officers out there, and building a force that's large enough and has enough platforms for us to be able to cycle them through is going to allow us to identify earlier even perhaps the senior superior leadership that we're going to need once they would actually get to a nominal commander command or even a commodore of an influence squadron, an 06 command or a Desron or something else. But, you know, I've always been in favor of trying to push command opportunities earlier.
Yeah, it is. And another tragedy is within living memory, we've seen this. One of the best flag officers I've worked for, Cutler Dawson, he had a lieutenant command, a lieutenant commander command, a captain command, a shore command. So by the time he put on his first star, he knew the intricate details. And you could see that in how he worked day to day, as opposed to having command thrown at him real fast. And I think another large tragedy that you see in some communities is they'll have a front runner. He doesn't see command until his commander command, and that commander command tour is abbreviated.
Yes.
And so he just does not have much time under his feet or doesn't get much underway time to do that. Eagle One, do you have a question? Okay.
I was going to make a comment. I was going to make a comment that I'm old enough to have served on the Gearing class destroyers when they had lieutenant commanders as commanding officers. So, that was an interesting time, and it was a great experience. And the skipper I had, who was a lieutenant commander, had been a lieutenant command of a minesweeper before that. So he had a lot of experience at sea.
Well, and I'll tell you, the other thing that comes into play with that is that, command is not just about, in fact, it's not about commanding systems. It's about commanding people and the ability to grow the skills of dealing not only with your subordinates, but in the situation with an influence squadron as well, is dealing with coalition partners on sort of a man-to-man basis or even leaders ashore, as I envision a lot of these working in the nearshore arena with local communities, et cetera, doing humanitarian or security operations. You're really going to grow sort of the diplomatic sailor commander that historically was a characteristic of our Navy since its inception. And I would like to see us grow those sort of more rounded leaders such that when they become flag officers, we could see a whole lot more Jim Stavridis's in our leadership.
Absolutely, and that's the one thing that I like, that tie-in, intentional or not, of bringing in that idea about early command and influence squadrons, because inside of that concept, you could very well see the hosted dinner at social at Country X, where you have half dozen or so commanding officers standing around from two or three different nations,
yeah.
And they, he met them when he was a lieutenant commander. And when he's on his commander command, they do a port visit. He does his major command at sea. He happens to run into him at some conference. So here we are working in whatever multinational contingency operation you have, and in walks Admiral from Country X to talk with one of our admirals. They go over, shake hands, and they've known each other for over a decade. That's something that we've lost the ability to do from a structural standpoint. We've really done it to ourselves. Maybe that's something that goes into the equation. But looking locally, with your concept about influence squadrons, I also liked how you brought out a benchmark there, because some of the discussions about wanting to keep away from smaller ships, lower manned ships, lower end ships, I hate to use that phrase, but that's what other people will use, is the fact that it will take away from what little money is available for our high-end blue water Navy. If you could take for a second and discuss how the influence squadrons really are not a threat to that pile of money.
Well, again, that comes back to, you know, the black swan influence and this 10 and 90% investment. Right now, you know, over the last 10 years, on average, we've invested about $12.9 billion per year in shipbuilding. So let's just round that to 13. And so what the challenge I set for myself in writing this article and making specific recommendations on the force structure was to spend no less than 10% of our overall shipbuilding budget, which is less than the cost of an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. And so out of that, by selecting the platforms I did, the TAKE as a mothership, looking at these 150-foot coast patrols and Austal's MRV-90 and then, you know, a Riverine detachment, all of that sum totaled together comes up to less than $1.3 billion. And so, you know, what I'm able to do is get about 10 ships or 10 platforms worth of presence out there for less than 10% of the SCN. The other 90% is still going to be invested in your high-end platforms. It's going to go towards your Arleigh Burke-class destroyer or whatever comes next. It's going to go towards building submarines. It's going to go towards aircraft carriers if we continue to build those or in some form or fashion, and your amphibs. But at the low end, I'm going to have all these things. The other criticism that came up, and I wanted to raise it because it was a criticism that came up over the last year since Ford versus Ferraris came out, was, you know, what are we going to use these things in wartime? Well, one of the things that I've seen over the last 6 months or so is I've looked at various different wargaming scenarios, especially in an anti-access air denial environment, is that there will be somewhat of a pullback of the perimeter, in a lot of these games and a lot of these scenarios. And you're going to have something that can logistically support a dispersed force across a broad perimeter, and not to mention monitor different inlets between archipelagic waters, et cetera. You're going to need a large patrol force, and you're going to need a larger logistical force. And the influence squadron ships naturally feed into that force structure, even at the high end, as our high-end vessels would penetrate in order to try and do power projection within that anti-access environment. And so I think it's a balanced force at the right price that increases our presence without significantly impacting into the SCN budget.
Eagle One.
Well, in thinking about Moneyball and the Black Swan, one of the things that strikes me is that if you go and look at naval history, at the biggest source of trouble for navies has been mine warfare over the years, and it seems to be the place we put the least amount of money and certainly pay the least amount of attention, but which brings the greatest amount of damage to us. How, both internally in the U.S. Navy and in dealing with our international navies, how would you view mine warfare as part of this influence squadron concept?
Well, it is something that I didn't touch upon in the article. I wrote this article back in November, December timeframe, and then submitted it, you know, for all these, you know, checks and security and everything because of where I work. And then it got to the Institute. In hindsight, I wish that I had thrown in a mine warfare component because, A, it can be purchased at a fairly low cost. B, it could serve in a multi-ways, meaning it just mine warfare ships don't just provide mine warfare. They could also be coastal patrol and presence operations. And the third thing is essentially they're not that expensive in the overall scheme of things, and so I could easily see, you know, a mine warfare component being integrated into the influence squadron. Now the one thing, and I make this very clear in the article, I didn't see LCS as being part of the influence squadron, or at least within an influence squadron that's purchased with 10% of the shipbuilding budget, because right now LCS at $600 million without a mission module is simply going to eat up too much of that portion of the budget. And so I avoided it altogether. But if LCS is going to be your mine warfare vehicle, and I'm going to purchase that anyway, you know, I could see LCS being tacked on to the influence squadron.
Another quote that you kind of touched on it just a second ago, and you brought up something that we've talked about on and off here for the last month or so is the upcoming austere fiscal environment that I think is underappreciated when you look forward 10 years from now on the macro budgetary effects that we have, and also our allies are going to have. You look at, people call them the pigs, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, Spain. Of those nations, Italy and Spain especially have a significant naval capability. As things get crunched, and for us, the 2020s is also going to be where we've got to recapitalize our strategic deterrence. Do you see that appreciation beginning to be understood about how we have got to find the best way to get a bang for a buck, which I think your latest article gives us some clues on how to do that, because austere fiscal environment, it's coming here and it's going to hit us like a 100-pound sledgehammer.
Well, that discussion has to occur at two levels. In the micro level, where we've been doing a lot of this discussion, is that, hey, I need to buy smaller, cheaper, but more numerous platforms. And so I need to spend my money more wisely. On a macro level, I think it's time for the country to step back. And certainly as we look at the years ahead, as we're exiting out of Iraq and exiting out of the land warfare in Afghanistan, we need to look strategically. What is the compelling narrative of the United States' role in the world? And then we're going to need, on a broader strategic, of what type of broad military force we're going to need. I think we're entering another maritime age where the United States' prime influence slash, coercive power in the world is going to come from either the air or the sea. And we're going to have to realign our macro investment strategies, perhaps decrease funding for ground forces or look at, somehow cheapen, what we're going to do with the ground forces in order to reinvest and redistribute towards the maritime and air forces. And so I know that would be sacrilege in many Army and Marine Corps circles, maybe not so much perhaps with the Marine Corps, which was a maritime force. But I think that we're going to have to look at that macro strategic level and look at coming perhaps from the sea again, not necessarily tying into the 96 strategy, but actually operating diplomatically from the oceans, from the commons.
Well, we've got about a minute and a half left. Eagle One, did you have a last quick question for Jerry before we sign off?
Well, I was one of the things that a lot of articles, especially I was reading one here by the Canadian Maritime Admiral, who's talking about the fact that we seem to have lost naval visibility, that we've become the invisible force. Among other things, in where we approach things, how can we get people thinking about national security with 90% of the world's goods being sent by sea? How do we worry keeping about the commons open? How do we get that message out?
Well, I think right now, quite frankly, the blogosphere is doing a lot of that. But I think the other thing is to come up with a compelling narrative. The story of how the United States is a maritime navy, our nation that it historically has been. And then to highlight certain things. I think the impeccable incident from last year where Chinese fishing, fisheries boats came out and interfered with our unarmed surveillance ship, to talk about piracy. Americans instinctively understand that piracy is a core mission for their Navy. In fact, it's the only mission that's enshrined in the Constitution as a mission that the Navy is maintained, not raised, but constitutionally maintained to protect us from piracy. And so we understand, that trade is important to our country. I think that we need to kind of step back, because we want to talk about sort of the juicy things, the steaks out there, in the supermarket, like BMD and Aegis and those things, which are important. But there's some core basic missions that the Navy provides this country day in, day out, and has done so for over 200 years. If you come home to that and talk to the American people about it, they're going to understand, and they will come in support of their Navy.
And, Jerry, on that, I think we're going to wind it up for the day. And thank you very much for coming on as a repeat visitor. And we also see you lurking in the chat room now and then for some of our more interesting shows. Thank you very much for coming on for Mid-Rets this afternoon.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much,
Andrew. And we will definitely be calling on you later on this year for more topics. And I would like to tell everybody to please join us again next week. We have another Saturday special, Mid-Rats, going to be a little longer. We're going to do a 60-minute segment, then a 30-minute segment. It's going to be held live from the Navy Memorial in Washington, D.C., where they're having the Blessing of the Fleet ceremony and a dedication of a new Supply Corps exhibit. Keep an eye on our blogs this week as we'll outline the guest list we're going to have for the show. It's going to be a little bit different show, but it's going to be a good show. Hopefully the cherry blossoms will come out. Thank you very much for joining us today. Have a great Navy Day.